Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Help TVO create a better world through the power of learning. Visit TVO.org and make a tax-deductible donation today.
With 17 albums and 3 Juno Awards to his name, singer-songwriter Ron Sexsmith is a critical part of the Canadian songbook. He also just turned 60 and celebrated this milestone with a retrospective performance at Toronto's iconic Massey Hall. His latest record is called The Vivian Line, and Ron Sexsmith joins us here in our studio. I'm going to start by saying it's great to have you back here, Mr. Sexsmith. Yeah. You won't remember this, but you were here probably 25 years ago to do a show we used to do here called Studio 2. Now, yeah. Don't tell me you remember that because it's too long ago.
You know, I have vague memories of it. I do. because I remember we did a book thing a while back Dundurn or whatever that was.
Yes.
And I remember thinking, I've been watching on TV for so long, but I thought, there was a show that I was a part of. But you know, you do so many. I mean, I did so many morning shows. When was that? Was that a morning show?
Or
was
No. It aired in the evenings.
Right.
And you, I remember the producer of the segment said to me, "We got to get this guy now because he's going to get big, and we'll never be able to get him again."
Boy, was he wrong, wasn't he?
No. Au contraire.
Do you remember what song I played?
I do not.
Okay.
I do not.
I wonder if there's any footage. I would love to see that.
You know, there is. And here's the problem. Because when I knew you were coming in, I said we got to try and get the footage of this.
Yes.
But it was so long ago, it's on 1-inch videotape.
Right.
It's not digital.
Wow.
And we don't have any machines in this building that'll play 1-inch videotape anymore.
Right.
So that's the problem. That's why we probably won't see a clip from it here.
Wow. And also, I would, you know, the ravages of time, I would be like, oh my God, I was a baby then. Or whatever.
The ravages have been pretty kind to you. You still got a bit of a baby face.
I have a face anyway, you know. I mean, the thing is, I've just noticed, especially since the pandemic, like, you know, losing it on top and all these sort of humbling things that happen, you know, as you move, go forward in life. And I'm trying to be okay with it because I see people sometimes that they're just very comfortable in their own skin, and I've never been totally comfortable.
Darling, be happy with it.
Thank
you. Those of us in our 60s need to be just grateful that we're still upright.
Amen. I am really trying to be okay with it. But, you know, I have this job, and you have this job too, but like I had to walk, you know, you have to walk out on stage, and you feel like you let people down, you know, if you don't look a certain way. I think that's why so many performers will go under the knife and do all these things, and I will never do that. But I know that people aren't coming to see me expecting me to look the way I did, you know, in the 90s, or expecting me to look like, you know, Brad Pitt or something. But it still, it plays tricks with your head sometimes. Like, you know, you pass a mirror and, you know, a store window and like, oh my God, you're thinking you're looking good and then something shoots you down all the time.
I'm pretty sure they're coming to hear your music as opposed to make sure that you look like Clark Gable or George Clooney.
And I know, and that's it, that's true. And I used to even write notes and put them on the ground by my mic stand saying, you know, like, open your eyes, you know, or, you know, you've got this, or all this kind of stuff.
Good.
Good. Motivational notes. Yeah.
Can you, let's go back. I really want to, you're from St. Catharines, Ontario.
Yes.
I'm from Hamilton, not too far away.
Rival towns, kind of.
Not too much, because there's not much of a rivalry when one city's so much better than the other. But anyway, that's another story.
No, you're right.
Did you come from a musical family?
I'm going to say no. But I did come from a family where my mom let me play the records in the house. My dad left when I was very young, but he left his records. So when I was old enough to put them on the turntable, you know, my 45s and things, they were, you know, a box that my dad had left. You know, some of them had his name written on them, or my mom. A lot of it doo-wop and country music. And I was just fascinated by these records, you know. I wanted to know what the A side was or the B side was. And I thought it was amazing how everyone had their own voice, such unique voice. I find a lot with today, you know, there's a lot of affectation and sometimes you can't tell one singer from the next. But back then you couldn't mistake, you know, like Buddy Holly from Johnny Cash or Dusty Springfield from Karen Carpenter. I mean, they just had these very unique things. So I just became obsessed with, and also all the music on the radio.
So you think that planted a seed with you?
It really did. And nothing else connected with me, you know? I mean, I liked soccer, I guess, but music, like my brothers were always outside running around, and I was always like sitting by the stereo or by the, or even if you played road hockey or something, there'd be a transistor radio right on the curb, you know, playing the hits of the day. So it really did, you felt like, you know, it was a bit of a soundtrack, you know, mm-hmm. to some movie you were in.
How old were you when you picked up the guitar for the first time?
I was about 14 and I got forced into it. I had started a band with some friends just because it seemed cool. Not because we had any talent, but, and I just wanted to be the singer, you know? I wanted to be like Roger Daltrey with the mic. And nobody wanted to play guitar. And I got sort of shamed into getting it was like a silver tone guitar from Sears. And,
but 14's kind of late, isn't it, to pick up the guitar?
I know, and the thing is, my first love was always piano, but, you know, I play piano now, like, badly, but I can write on it. But, you know, it was sort of the bane of my existence was my mom played piano when she was a kid, and the piano that was at my grandparents' house was supposed to come to her. And it ended up going to her sister, and they used it to put plates on. You know, like had a doily hanging on it. And if that piano came to us, I would be just like Liberace by now, you know. So I didn't start playing until I was like in late 30s or 40 or something. So
you didn't come up with conservatory and all that business.
No, and I was self-taught, and you know, now I'm at a point where I can play and not look at my hands. But I didn't learn the right way. But the guitar was kind of like second prize for me. But I did get into it, and so I would say by the time I was around 17, you know, I was really into the Who and all that, and that's the kind of I wanted to be like Townsend and. So I do love the guitar, but initially I was kind of like, oh, why do I have to do this, you know? So.
We should say, you live in Stratford, Ontario today.
Yes.
You have not done what so many others do in this country, which is try to find fame and fortune south of the border. You've stayed here.
Yeah.
How come?
Well, there was a lot of pressure, you know, to move to L.A. initially because I was signed there. And at one point I even had an apartment there. That the label paid for back when labels had money, you know, it's insane. And also there was pressure at one point to move to England because the UK has always been my biggest market. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. It always meant a lot to me that Gordon Lightfoot didn't do that. Not that I have any problem with Joni or Neil going down to LA or Leonard. I get why they went, you know, because that's where it was happening at the time, and also that's where the nice weather was.
And lots of money.
Lots of money to be made, yeah. I guess I'm also, because I had kids, I had small kids, and I couldn't just sort of, you know, what's the word? I didn't want any upheaval, and they were going to school. And so there was pressure from different sources saying, you know, telling me, I probably have a better shot at, you know, making it, you know, in another place.
You know, Eugene Levy made the same decision you did.
He stayed.
He's lived in downtown Toronto his whole time.
Even when he was
making
all those movies
out there, he always stayed here.
Yeah.
Yep.
Wanted
his kids to be educated here, wanted to grow up knowing what it means to be Canadian.
And does Dan live here? Or does he
that I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah.
I did see, I was in Christmas shopping once at down, like, you know, uptown where all the fancy stores were, and I saw Eugene Levy shopping at Christmas, and I was like, "Whoa, that was a pretty starstruck moment." You know, those guys are incredible. You know,
but you, how do I put this? There's lots of sort of very famous musicians who have both recorded your stuff and admired your stuff. I'll name some of them here: Rod Stewart, Coldplay, Emmylou Harris, Katie Lang, Michael Bublé, Leslie Feist. Is she just Feist or is she Leslie Feist?
I call her Leslie, but I think, yeah.
Because she sometimes just goes by one name, right?
I think she's known as Feist.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. You've got this weird thing where you're, in some ways, well, you just referenced it, you're sort of more popular in other countries than you are here in Canada. Do you have a theory about why that is?
I think initially, if you look back on the 90s and what was happening musically, it wasn't what I was doing, you know? I mean, you could, you know, Pearl Jam, and it was a... Almost, there's a lot of, the music had a lot of kind of like anger.
It was harder.
Yeah, I don't know why. There seemed to be a lot of, this, and I didn't do that. So I would travel around, especially in America. I toured so much in the 90s down there, listening to the radio, and I didn't hear anything that sounded like what I was doing. They could not get me on the radio. And not, up here even, I didn't get a whole lot of radio. And I just think because I was a bit older, I didn't get signed until I was 30 or 31. And all my initial influences were British Invasion, the Kinks and the Beatles, obviously. And it was, so my sound was like the sort of folky stuff from the Canadian folk stuff and the British Invasion. And so when I finally, when my album was finally released in over there in 96, because the label was about to drop me in 95 because my record did not perform. They didn't like me. And it wasn't until Elvis Costello held my album up. It was December of 95 on a magazine, and that was really the shot heard around the world, because then that's when I found my audience. And I remember going to England the first time, and I got this hero's welcome. The band Squeeze opened up for me, and it was a band that I was a huge fan of. Mm. I met Paul McCartney the first week I was there, second week I had breakfast with. I mean, it was insane. After a year of touring, opening for everybody and nobody really caring, it felt kind of, I felt vindicated.
And yet, you celebrated your 60th birthday not too long ago with a sold-out show at Massey Hall. That's kind of cool, I would think.
I'm still kind of reeling from that,
because... And they sang happy birthday to you.
That was powerful. It wasn't even my birthday on that evening, but... Right. Massey Hall, that was like the fifth time I've played there, and I've always got a good crowd, but I've never, like, sold it out until, this show, and... but my mind is still back there, and I'm thinking about all the things that I thought went well and things that maybe could have done better,
I'm going to read a quote here from the Globe and Mail that is very honest.
Okay.
And I want to ask you a question that emerges from it. Here we go. Sheldon, put this up and I'll read along. I don't know that I've been the greatest dad or the greatest husband or anything, but I don't think that's what I'm here to do. I did my best, but songwriting is what I'm supposed to be doing. It's easier for me to almost be a better human being in a song than in real life.
Yeah.
That's quite an acknowledgement, and I wonder why you feel that way.
Well, I think that was from this documentary that they did called Love Shines. And I can't remember what the original question was, when they... but I think I was beating myself up a bit at the time, because I do have a lot of regret. I mean, when I found that I was going to be a father at 21. I found out when I was 20. In some ways, I wasn't, not ready for that. And I felt I had all these dreams, of making it in music. And I felt it's all gone out the window now. But in actuality, it was the opposite, because I didn't really become a songwriter till my son was born. And I felt like for sticking around, and doing, the right thing, that I was almost, I don't know, this will sound crazy, but I always felt, I was like, I was a gift, like, for doing the right thing, I'm going to give you this gift of song. Because I never wrote songs before, I know that just sounds nuts. But that's what, it gave me a sense of purpose. But, and for a long time, I was dad. I was reading the bedtime stories, going to the park, And then I was gone all the time, and I had so much regret about that. I think I was a good dad, but then it came a point where, I was away all the time, and I was almost felt like I was leading a double life, because I was having so much fun on the road and all the stupid things the musicians get up to. Mm. And I had so much guilt, and then I'd come home, and then I was dad again. And there's all this readjustment. Every time you come back, not just for you, but for them, to all of a sudden there's this guy in the house again, and it sort of disrupts the rhythm of what they're doing.
Well, that first kid is an adult now.
Yeah.
First kid is what, 34?
No, actually 39.
39,
and daughter is going to be 34.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Have you ever had a conversation with those kids which went something like, do you think my lengthy absences when you were growing up has damaged you?
I don't know if we've we've definitely, with my daughter, you know, we've talked, because it's hard to even broach these subjects. My current wife, Colleen, is very, she gets in there. She likes to, you know, I'm more of one of these guys, like, I just want everyone to be happy and I don't want to, you know, but you have these moments sometimes. And I know that it's hurt them, you know, not, especially my daughter, because she was younger when I started traveling. My son was 10 when all of a sudden, you know, and then of course that family unit fell apart, and again, even at that time, I was just trying to keep everyone, make everyone feel happy, and I've never been very good at, I don't come from that family that, you know, talks. I didn't have any really experience doing that. I do regret that. I think, but my relationship with my kids now, I think, is in some ways better than it has been. And I mean, not that it was ever bad. I wasn't like the, you know, dad yelled or, you know, anything like this. But I do have a lot of regret for being away so much, and for the fact that we couldn't keep it together. But at the same time, you know, I never would have met Colleen, and that's been, and you know, I feel that, yeah. And getting back to the quote, I just always felt the reason when I became a songwriter. I wanted a career before I started writing songs. You know, I do feel that, you know, having this experience, it gave me, I had to grow up in a hurry, and it gave me these things to write about. Before I had my kids, I don't know what I was writing about, just probably frivolous stuff, you know.
Well, Amy Skye talked about that when she was here once. She said after she became a mother, it so profoundly changed what she felt and what she wanted to write about that it was beautiful.
Yeah, and last, you know, when I played my show, you know, both my kids were there, and I sent out a couple songs. And I mean, you know, maybe I'll never know how hard it was for them, because they don't talk about it either. Like not having, like, one, you know, their dad's there and all of a sudden he isn't there. And probably at some point we'll have to sit down and have that talk. And but I think. I think they understand, they get it, that I have this purpose, I think, you know, and not that that's more important, but it's also how I made a living, you know.
And they understand that.
They understand that.
You talk through your music.
Yeah.
That's one way
you... I put all my emotions into my music. Yeah. I'm not good at confrontation. I'm not good with, you know. So I think they get it. I think they get me and... Yeah, I'd like to think so anyway. Yeah.
Can we talk about how you talk through your music, how you do what you do? What comes first with you, lyrics or music?
Well, you know, it's a bit of both. And kind of getting back to the quote, the thing about being a better person in the song, I think what I meant by that is, I think your best aspects, you know, when you have time to actually think about it and put it down in paper, the way you really feel, or the way you see things, or the person you would like to be, you can put your best, you know, face in a song. Mm. And you can't always live up to it in real life, because as much as you try, you know, because things happen, and I get stressed out by life, and I'm not good with change at all, you know. But songwriting has given me an outlet to pour all whatever confusion I'm wrestling with, or...
I chuckled there for a second, because you're a very gifted, talented person at what you do, and yet you are conveying an image of somebody who's like barely keeping it together.
Oh, no.
And it just doesn't feel that way from the outside.
Yeah, no, I have a lot of, I mean, my wife Colleen is a kind of a miracle in a way. She's so capable, and like I don't drive, you know, I don't have a cell phone. I really, it's kind of like my one, if I have a superpower, it's this, I'm laser focused on this one thing that I found that, oh, you know, that I could do this. You know, like when I started writing songs in Quebec when my son was a few weeks old, before that, I knew I wanted to play music, but I didn't really have any evidence to, you know, back it up. And so songwriting's just given me this thing that, you know, because you want to contribute to the world somehow, you know, and people do important things. Not that my songwriting is that important, but I just feel, well, that's what I can do. That's my, you know, gift to the world, or that's my body of work. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of useless in most areas of life. I try to be helpful though. I'm just my wife understands that, and I'd like to think I help her with things too.
I bet you're capable of giving advice. So why don't we finish up on that? Because your first big album didn't happen until you were in your 30s.
Yeah.
And, which is unusual, you know, for many recording artists.
These days, especially.
Yeah, in their 20s, exactly. Sometimes in their teens.
Yeah.
And you've done 17 albums since. So obviously you've kind of figured some stuff out. If somebody is an aspiring musician watching us now, based on your experiences, what advice would you give them?
Well, I think hanging in there. You know, for me, I worked as a courier for a number of years, and many people are telling me to pack it in. I mean, people close to me, you know, but it never would have happened, you know, if I listened to them. And I just had this, I was stubborn about it, you know, and I think so perseverance is very important. I mean, the whole landscape has changed. I wouldn't even know how to begin now. You know, before it was, you try to get labels to come see you play, or you send demos out. I don't really know how they do it now. But I think, so the only advice I would have is about the music. Like, I mean, obviously I write a certain kind of song. It's not the kind of song that Bieber does or whatever, but I'm sure there's the same amount of dedication to what they're doing. You know, I do the work. And I just think if you're going to be a songwriter, have a point of view, you know? Have your own thing. Have something that they can't get anywhere else, you know? Whether it's your own melody, whether, you know? And I mean, every song has its own melody, but I mean, most songwriters, if you look at their body of work, there's something recognizable. There's a thread that, like Van Morrison, there's a melody he does you could trace on all his records. Or Randy Newman, you know, or Warren Zevon, they have this point of view that, and it's not for everybody, but if you connect with it, it's like, you know, where have you been all my life, you know? And I think if you're going to be a songwriter, you know, have something to say, you know? Don't just sing about, you know, oh, she looks fine or whatever it is, or, you know, I don't know what they're singing about. But, you know, have something to say, because obviously the world, I mean, I get it, music can be escapism, and the world's very scary now. And I like to try to, like, for me, I like to write songs that are comforting, even for my own head, because I figure if it makes me feel better, that someone else is going to, it's going to resonate and maybe make them feel better. So that would be my advice. Just, you know, have something to say, you know.
Well, my suggestion is we not wait another 25 years before doing this again.
Yeah, I'm really happy to be here. We watch you all the time. I'm like, when are they going to ask me? So.
And here you are.
Thank you.
Ron, thanks so much for doing this.
Thanks, Steve.
The Agenda with Steve Paikin is made possible through generous philanthropic contributions from viewers like you. Thank you for supporting TVO's journalism.